There were a number of things, a couple of things I did. I have no explanation for them, except I think that when you live through a war and you know, the violence done to you over a period of years, you just live on adrenaline. You see, particularly if you're young, you feel you're not going to die.
Not going to die.
Yeah.
You're going to die? Or not,
or not going to die. But then these scary things happen. Being in a home that was bombed, and then and knocking down a brick wall and going into the next house and living there, you see.
Alfred, I need to clarify what you said.
Okay.
Because it's very important. I think you said you fear you are not going to die. Is that what you meant to say? Or did you fear
maybe
you
I
would die?
I fear that I would die, rather, you see. I remember I had a dream of peace in which I would join the British Army. This is during the war, and I went to my medical to be examined for the Army, and they wouldn't accept me. They placed me in Category 3, which this is like 4F in America. I remember trying to remonstrate with the doctors, saying, you've made a mistake, I'm a very strong person, I'm a boxer, for God's sake. I come from a family of fighters. I said, no, Alfred, they sort of looked at the map where I lived, you know, which is entirely devastated, and they had bad luck with people who came from that area in the Army. Anyway, I'm trying to find an explanation for what happened in Provincetown. I think the architect, Bob Teager, the brother. This fellow is Arthur Teager in this little frame. His brother Bob is an architect, and he reminds me that there was a big stir at the Hoffman School. He reminded me, he was an architect, and we visited his home, and he had aligned the beam of his house with the monument to the pilgrims, celebrating the pilgrims' first landing in America, see. I said, my God, that's magnificent, you know, this structure. We're now down in we're in Provincetown, that on our visit. He says, you remember when you tried to blow it up and you collected all that dynamite? And Hoffman said, we gotta get him. We don't want the police to get him. This will destroy my school. So Bobby knew my whereabouts, and the student body had combed the town for me. And they sort of cotched me and disarmed me. And I had no explanation for it. This is like the truck. I want to say about the truck where I seem to have offended the owners of one gallery in New York and the owner of another gallery in New York and 40 or 50 artists. If only that was so simple. The problem there was that the show was curated and put together by Maya Shapiro, you see. And this was to be the first boost that the second generation artists would get, you know, under the shadow of the massive publicity and money thrown at Pollock and all these people. And this was to go not to a private gallery in Houston, but to the newly opened Museum of Modern Art in Houston, and which is the director of which, the new director of this new facility, was a student of Maya Shapiro, and he had recommended me and my paintings, the paintings that would come to you, you see. So this is what happened there. It had a greater ramifications. Number one, Shapiro was to be my sponsor. I needed a sponsor very desperately for the immigration people. And that was out of the question now. And of course, Jerry McCaige was outraged by all of this. And when I got shot down in Houston, in a situation peripheral to all of this, I was banned from going anywhere near the museum, even. The only friend I had down there, other than the two fellows, David Percy Bell and J.R. Cooley took me there, was George Demoneal. George found all of this amusing and wonderful, and he was an oil man, a geophysicist who represented Schlumberger in the United States. Schlumberger. Mm-hmm. Americans call it Schlumberger, I call it Schlumberger, and people don't, you know.
Yeah.
But he presented machinery to the industry that could search for inclines and synclines below the ground, and so you had a better chance of oil. And of course, he was a great collector. We visited his home, and it was just a marvelous place. When you approach the home of George Demoneal, incidentally, you're confronted by a brick wall of sort of mature brick that had been brought to the site. And the driveway into the house was, you know, what you'd get in an urban surround. You know, this wasn't a huge driveway through impressive gates. So the sign of this brick wall that was maybe 85 or 100 feet long was somewhat disconcerting. You know, what lay behind this wall and one door? But there were two coach lamps, you see, which indicated some gentrification of all this. Anyway, we knocked on the door and we were ushered in to the foyer of the Demoneal home, and you saw neither stone nor wood. Everything was glass, right out to the garden. There were partitions, I don't know what, and it was truly magical. Like the outside, there was sculpture, outside sculpture, inside by Bruck, and paintings by Picasso. It was really breathtaking, the home of this man. Also, his boon companion was a lady there from Martinique in the West Indies. And she had one of these delightful, this headgear where a knot would indicate that she is married or not. I forget what. But this charming lady was the cook and bath wash and everything else. Anyway, I met the only painter who's really working there, who would make any sense, or were people doing Texas cowboys and stuff like that, as people do the bears up here, and that was Forrest Bess. And
that was what?
Forrest Bess, an American painter. He would invariably paint little dead bodies, really, you see, or things that looked like an incubus or come on in, yeah. Anyway.
Wait a minute, because the noise, sometimes I can hardly hear you on the tape if there's one on it.
So I'd seen Forrest Bess's work. He showed in New York, you know, and there were some paintings of his. But I mean, the vision of this guy was apparent. And what we were looking at were was the stuff that would form the basic collection of the Museum of Modern Art down there. I opined to Demonil that I thought that George Poindexter was a madman, and I wished that I could buy him out. And he said, "Alfred, you idiot, you know, you can't buy out old money. No way." He said that you might go to Alaska and get an oil lease, you see. And his wife runs a gallery now, and you could buy the gallery. You know, he'll go for that, you see, but this business of buying him out is ridiculous. The man is, he's rich. Anyway, I always remember that. You know, I came up here somewhat involuntarily, but when I met Patty, we got married, the business of oil leases came up, and I acquired two oil leases at a place called Prudhoe Bay. And I remember Demonil saying, "All you need is one. All you need is one." And I had two. And that acreage was about over 3,000 acres, was taken over by the state. And we lost this acreage. The state took it over. It was what we acquired was what's called under federal law a priority leasehold. We paid rent on it. And this is how oil leases all over the United States of America, beginning in Pennsylvania to Texas, Oklahoma, California, all of these states made oil leases available to the people. See, the oil companies would come in and you'd receive a royalty on this. So our development via the oil companies is different in all of these other states. In these other states, you have individuals who become very wealthy, you see. We don't have people who become very wealthy. What we do have is a yearly check, you know. What the magnitude of it would be that if there's $20 million or more, I rather think, in the permanent fund, this is really money that should have gone into the ranks of the people, you know, what they could do with it, you see. And you don't see that here. You have this, you know, I don't want to characterize it as sort of a socialistic thing, but, and then I'm prejudiced, you know. I remember I once went to a lecture by some oil man, and he was pointing to this area, so we were unfamiliar with Prudhoe Bay, and His stick passed over my, you know, what once belonged to me under, you see. Well, anyway, I always remember that advice from Demonil. It says, there's a place called Alaska where you can get land and there's oil up there, my boy. You know? And we've had instrumentation up there. And believe me, there's oil. You have as good a chance as anyone else. The state took all this and they had under the state, under their entitlement with respect to the federal government, they had a right to 10 million acres, did the state of Alaska. And normally a state will choose acreage for infrastructure, highways, townships, or what have you, or facilities, public facilities. No, they grabbed this area, this meridian, all of our leases, and then made them available to the seven oil companies who predominantly sold it to them. So you have money that in the ranks of politicians, and it's a hell of a problem. You don't have what you have in Texas or California. It's bad. So anyway, that was one sub-dream that I had in coming up here. And you can imagine how enthusiastic I was. And I thought, my God, I'm going to go back to New York and buy back, you know, take over the gallery, buy the gallery, you know.
No.
Anyway, the attempt to dynamite the Pilgrim's Monument.
Do you remember that, or how?
Yes, I remember it. I remember that it's something that one would have to do. Then we'd have dignitaries that visited the school, and there was one lady who was an enthusiastic buyer of paintings of Hoffman, and she wondered if there was anyone who could sail her. She rented a sailboat, and I immediately volunteered to sail. They crashed into the Provincetown ferry, which is tying up, you see, which was terrifying to her, of course. She wound up, you see, and Hoffman was furious over that. And then what involved all of his students, many guys who were showing at the Art Association, like this transfer of paintings and the fiasco, he thought that, he said exactly right, that this is what happens to people who go through a war, you know. I just kind of, had a massive resentment, you know, guilt about surviving things, and then you come to this country and everything seems so happy. Why not, you know? And I've learned that the pursuit of happiness is in our constitution. But there's no other country on the earth that has a clause like that. No other nation, you know.
What do you think about that?
I think it's wonderful, except when I went to California and met Californians, and these people without gray hair, you know, with faces without crinkles or seams or character, and all of them have something they're going to do that day that involves golf or yachting or this or that, you know, and I look at them at first with great resentment, wondering what mischief I could do, and then I thought, you know, these are there's an occupational hazard about being happy all the time. So, you know, I thought about the Constitution, you know, your right. And I think that registered with me after they took almost a decade for that to register with me, that happiness is great, you know.
And possible, I guess.
And possible, yeah. Mm-hmm. And in the East, when I was there, I just had great resentment of of freedom. I couldn't believe how free. I mean, imagine I jump ship. I find a job in the middle of the morning. Then I get out. Then I walk across town. I mentioned what tailors look like. I forgot one other. There's always invariably a tailor who's wearing shades, sunglasses. Glasses on the street. Okay. They're fellows with bandaged fingers when they didn't have antibiotics that could target, you know, a finger that infested. And there were fellows with dark shades. Because the Duke of Windsor made houndstooth checks popular, and the tailors who worked on them, hated them, would go blind. And the blindness would be what up here we call snow blindness, see? And they'd have to quit work until they regained their eyesight. And they just hated houndstooth checks. The difficult to explain. You know, either you feel guilty, and I overcame that, you know, survival. And then this is what happens to you. You want to you want to smash things that are, you know, that are precious to people, you know.
Because
you resent their happiness. You resent the tranquility and that they've enjoyed, and which you haven't. And this would be a recurrent thing when I would be with art and in places like Provincetown, sometimes in New York, except that in New York, I meant to say that jumping ship, finding a job that morning, getting out of that job, and then finding another job in the afternoon, and on the evening of the same day, shaking hands with the President of the United States. And I thought, I was very nervous about that, and then I thought, he's going to look at me and he's going to say, "This son of a bitch jumped ship here," said Harry Truman, "and get him out of here. How can you pull something like this?" But that didn't happen. But I mean, it's a kind of a miracle that these things happen. These things don't happen in England. You don't find a job like that in England. In England, wherever you go, you have insurance cards that are given to you by the government. You're under a social contract, and that identifies you. See, I remember saying to Scotty, I said, "I don't have cards. I can't get a job." He says, "You don't need cards. All you need is a social security card, and I'll get you that. It'll take a few minutes." Unbelievable. In England, you had to have a national identity card to identify yourself. You don't have this. I don't know how they figure out who is who. Obviously, people state who they are, you know. I mean, in these amorphous cities and places where a cop doesn't walk the beat, but is on a motorcycle, and he accepts information from you and writes out a ticket, but you've not really identified yourself. It's always unbelievable to me, you see. So this is, you know, freedom. I couldn't believe it. And I thought, well, it's in the Constitution to be happy. And of course, I don't know what the British have. They certainly don't have it in the Constitution. I don't think they have a Constitution in England. That matter. Sure, the Brits will, but they do have cricket, you see, and the morality of cricket, and as a democratic leveler amongst people. The British were kicked out of Afghanistan. They fought there across, you know, a century. Did they fight in? Along the Khyber Pass that dissects that country. You would think that great enmity has arisen because, but oh no. Last year, the Afghanistanians arrived in London to play cricket. They won the world title, and one of their batsmen was a handsome-looking, Pakistan was the country in question, also had,
all the way along. See, yeah. Where's the Khyber Pass? Is that Pakistan?
That knife through both the countries that I mentioned, like Afghanistan
and
yeah.
Pakistan.
Yeah, and the guy was at the level of a rock star in America, you know. The women were just swooned at the sight of this fellow, you see. Who is Sir Leary Constantine? Sir Leary came from one of the West Indies islands and was a marvelous batsman, cricketer. He was knighted by the Queen. Football, or you know, soccer, is not one of these benighted games, and its greatest player, Stanley Matthews, was at long last was the first soccer player to be knighted by the Crown. See, so cricket, like Is It Fair, is a British attitude that permeates law, or the spirit of law. You know, even though we don't have a constitution, and yet we enjoy things that is our part of our inheritance, the jury system, and things like this. I remember there were a bunch of British mountain climbers here, and the hospital called me, and they said, "Who's going to pay the bill on these guys?" I said, I don't know. Why the hell are you calling me? I'm not even a consul." And I said, "How much is it, by the way?" They said, "Oh, it's about $8,000, which seemed very reasonable to me. And she said, "They don't want to pay it." I said, "They don't want to pay it because in England, where they are from, the rights of a foreigner were spelled out in the Magna Carta. And it says, thou shalt not suffer, you know, thou shalt not torture the alien amongst you, you see, and you must cause it and care for him. And this is better, and pay for his medical treatments, you see. The Magna Carta."
Right, I know about that, but I mean, the question I have is, was this recently that somebody called you about?
This was about 5 years ago.
Why would they, and who called you?
Some British climbers. The hospital called me.
And they called you because?
I was familiar to them, because I served as a chaplain, and I've been in and out of that hospital. Okay. And they thought, this guy's from England, and maybe he could solve this puzzle.
Okay.
And I said, no, I said, they come from a country where they don't do this to a foreigner. They don't charge him. They don't, and that's all there is to it. And maybe you should talk to, a British consul in Seattle or San Francisco, and they might send you some money or tell you what I told you. You know, why this country doesn't have a Magna Carta beats the hell out of me, you know, with respect to medical expenses of, the alien in our midst, yeah. So they do have compensatory things that have evolved, you know. How does a fellow like Ted Willis get into the House of Lords, you know? This friend of mine, you know, running around wild, both of us, at the end of the war. I mean, but he explained to me that if you're a troublemaker, then you wind up in the House of Lords. That's how you are neutralized, you see? And that's true, you know, but we really don't neutralize people that way in this country, not in politics, you know. Once there was a strike that was different from all other strikes. It was really a revolutionary thing where the entire economy of a nation was brought to a standstill by unions that united, and they formed a general strike. This is in the early 30s that the general strike occurred in England. The leader of the strike was a Scottish gentleman, union leader named Ramsay MacDonald. And anyway, he led a march of 150,000 people to London. And when they do that, they either march to Buckingham Palace and raise all sorts of hell. Or in the old days, they would come to town and kill all the lawyers, which is what one bunch did, and demanded to see the king. The king was a young King Richard, who met them at Mile End Gate. And he was the king. The young king was young, all right. He was 12 years of age, surrounded by his knights. And the young king decided that these seemed like reasonable men. And he said that, upon my word, you shall receive what your demands will be satisfied by the crown. And Wat Tyler, who was the leader of this revolutionary medieval group, approached the king and touched him. And a knight ran him through with the spear. You cannot touch the king. Neutralize a person. But anyway, at that time, Wat Tyler arrived with 50 or 60,000 peasant types, you see. And Wat Tyler.
W-A-T-T?
Yeah. The second in command was a guy named Jack Straw, who was from the north. We now, the government in England, their Home Secretary is a fellow named Jack Straw.
Straw?
Straw.
Straw.
S-T.
R-A-W.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's these psychical things that evolved in this way. You have people who talk in England about this king is a ridiculous business. But then you learn that if they're from the north, they want they want the Stuarts to sit on the throne. You see, so if you just scratch them, they will want a Stuart. Why didn't we have a Stuart? Or what about Queen Mary, Queen of Scots, you know? I think I love England, but I really believe in the United States.
Do you feel like you're an American?
I feel like I'm an American, you see. I believe in the transparency and a democratic way of doing things, you see. And this is something I'm learning, really, and it always astonishes me, you know. I never had a voice, really, except in art when I came here, but I've accepted responsibilities, and it's just a miracle. I run into other Englishmen who are kind of relatively mute and don't understand this system, you see. I like America.
Do you ever still feel that you're affected by the war? Anyway, is that pretty much in the past?
It's pretty much in the past, but I compulsively will watch war movies, you know, uttering kill 'em all, you know, if the Germans are getting bombs dropped on them, you see. You don't ever forget what your own personal situation was, and it really profoundly affects your self-esteem to be targeted, you know, for mass murder by the enemy. The silver lining were Americans who came to England, I just remember those handsome, beautiful people, you know, wonderful, marvelous people. And I thought, my God, I have relatives who live in America, and they are Americans. And I thought, I'm going to see them one day. We had one fellow I learned who came from Brooklyn. His parents owned a liquor store. He was their only son, and he died on his last mission. He was a captain in the Air Force. And I thought, you know, we could, and Americans look different. They're sort of freer in their limbs, you know, and I thought, yeah, in this country, I think I aspire towards things that are ridiculous, you know, like I did want to see the West and places where cowboys live. On one trip to Los Angeles, there was another Englishman on the Greyhound bus. And that is a degree of difficulty, talking to another Englishman, because of class divisions. Mm-hmm. They will never shake hands unless they've been to the same school. You know, and this is a free and easy gesture amongst Americans, the simple act of shaking hands. Mm-hmm. You really have to find out about the other fellow. Of course, you might say that to shake hands with somebody means that you're under a serious obligation. I remember there was a wonderful cartoon that I used to enjoy when I was a kid, which describes this. And there was this heroic figure and his crew of honorable sailors who were captured by a bunch of rascally pirates. And they beat them up, and these rogues would be drunk all the time, and they had them down in the, you know, in these foul quarters in the ship. And then once again, they'd arrive in some place in the Spanish main, some port, and the pirates were all going ashore once again to get drunk. Anyway, the captain, who had a peg leg and an eye patch, of course, goes down below to talk to the prisoners. And our hero is a fellow with a name like Dudley Do-Right. And he approaches Dudley Do-Right and he says, I say there, Dudley, you won't be trying to escape, will you? And Dudley and his friends are all listening for his answer. And he said, no, I won't, you know, seeking to get this guy off his back and off the ship. And he said, and the pirate said, well then, let's shake hands upon it. And to everyone's horror, Dudley shook hands with the pirate, and the pirate staggered and knew that he had the fellow. But,
changed. This is a gesture of honor.
Yeah, and you see, and his companion was trying to say, well, we don't have to, I mean, the man's a bloody pirate, and Dudley was saying, oh, God, we can't escape now, I shook his hand, you saw me shake his hand, and then this nightmare, you see, and so that's what involves, you know, shaking hands, you see, although I don't see that obligation, but I see where, you know, I still see people are very inhibited about doing this. Because Americans are not like that, thank God.
Did you lose anybody in the war, people you knew or close to or killed?
A third of my schoolmates were killed.
In bombings,
yeah. Of course, they weren't exactly cowering in shelters. They served as messengers, as I did, delivering messages. And a lot of them were killed that way. One won a George Medal, which is a high decoration for a civilian. And he was all of about 16, got cut in half, you know. Then I had Germans, like the pirates, would do really hideous goddamn things, you know. One was dropping toys on schools, and the first time I ever saw anodized metal,
kind of a brushed
story. Yeah, it's, you used to see it in the modern furnishings, you know, with curves, you know, of the 30s. And you had these bright golden and sky blue hues, and it's a technique of dipping this metal, I think, in cyanide and stuff like that. And it's very unreal and pretty. Anyway, those bastards made these butterfly bombs that were brightly colored this way, just to attract children. So I lost kind of a second cousin through that, a six-year-old. But there were there were very sort of jolly things too, I remember, about the war, you know, like people discussing a bombing attack as though it's like the weather, you know, that people could anticipate bombs raining down, the way you look at the sky and say, yes, it'll rain, stuff like that. But I don't know whether you ever get used to it, you see. And then when you come to a country where this is a boring matter to bring up, that really pisses you off, you know, with all of that, with the war going on, I run and jog and do exercises. And there are parts of the district which I lived that were so devastated that they would put tape around them, and this was off limits. There was a reason for that. The reason was that there are no people living there, and it is a good idea going into this area, because there'd be no rescue effort made in this area that has been roped off, you see. But these were ideal areas for exercising and jogging. So you could run on roads that have been cleared up, you see.
You'd go under the tape to get to them?
Or? Yeah, or I'd jump over the tape. And one day, I don't think I'd ever bother to look at these houses that have been flattened invariably. And then I heard a plane, and it was a buzz bomb, really. And the only reminder I have of war is you would have these motorcycles when I came to the United States. And the roar of a motorcycle would evoke a flying bomb. And if I was asleep, I'd wake up. It would be a nightmare. Or my instinct, if I heard a motorbike, would be to I'd look for a table to jump under. And I had these experiences here when they had these European bikes, you know, these Czech Skoda vehicles, you know. They had that full-throated roar. But then, no, I don't have this, I don't have that, you know.
Anymore.
I don't even have dreams about that, you know. I'm in this area, and these the buzz bombs, which were the first of so-called secret weapons, victory weapons, said the Germans. Were actually more terrifying. They were supposed to be a gradation in terror, but that wasn't true. The rockets, which was V2. Well, it was a weapon that people were very fatalistic about. They didn't care. You couldn't hear them coming, you know. And they did little damage. They just smash a hole in the ground. They destroy one house. But the V1, it was horrible. I mean, it wouldn't crash into the ground. It would land on rooftops and blast blocks of houses, you see. The only fair thing about it was you could hear it coming. You couldn't hear a rocket coming. Anyway, here I am in this roped-off area, and I dove into a collapsed doorway down what was left of the staircase and found a table. It just amazes me how you find these things. And then crash, and then what remained of the roof came crashing down. I found I couldn't get out of what I'd gotten into. And then I realized that there'd be no rescue teams because it was a devastated area. I was there for the rest of the day, all night, and got out miraculously the following day at noon. I was under a table. To say under a table means, you know, it would be commodious. No, the legs had been smashed. A roof had collapsed on it. A dog was released that sniffs for corpses or people in ruins. And they would release them in these areas to defecate. And the little bastard found me.
And it let them know that you were...
Yeah. And they called him back just to say, there's nobody here. And the dog insisted that there was somebody and wouldn't go back. See? And they yanked me out there. Just routine. Sometimes I used to think about how fast I can go down a staircase. I was in this rotunda-like building. It's an old brick building, and it went down like this, like the Guggenheim Museum. And a bomb hit the main building on which this circular staircase. I remember getting to the bottom and out of the building, and then the whole thing collapsed, you see. An adrenaline rush. You wouldn't feel you have to do something, and you would do it, and there wouldn't be any fear. But then after you go into a shock, after you would be kind of susceptible to things,